Chapter 37. The Appeal to Caesar. Novel, strange, and unexpected things are always coming to pass in a great city. The day after Paul's trial, a peculiar secret society was formed in Jerusalem. 40 or more men who appear to have been so well acquainted that they would not trust each other except under oath, solemnly swore that they would neither eat nor drink until they had killed Paul. The special folly of this action lay in the fact, of which the members of this misguided society were of course in ignorance, that the Lord arranged a program by which the apostle was to take a trip to Rome at public expense, and these Jews learned that many a man has since discovered that before one can safely take an oath to perform some act, he should be reasonably certain that he and the Lord are on the same side, else he is in danger of committing perjury. Paul's nephew overheard the plot and brought word to the apostle, who took him to the chief captain, and that night, to the martial tread of a splendid guard, the world-famous journey to Rome began in accordance with the program of which the 40 conspirators were still in ignorance. The first stop was made at Caesarea, the royal headquarters, and here Paul was detained for his second hearing before Felix, the governor. It was 5 days before the Jerusalem conspirators succeeded in bringing on the hearing, and the law's delays probably never seemed so grievous as to the hungry 40 whose stomachs were clamoring for speedy justice. They were just then greatly in favor of the sentiments suggested by the poet when he wrote, "And wretches hang that jurymen may dine, the hungry judge is quick the sentence sign." And it is to be feared that much of the clamor for quick justice and the punishment of men who violate the law, without stopping to think of the after results, is about as unselfish. Paul alive meant the epistle to the Galatians and the conversion of Europe, but Paul dead meant a square meal to 40 conspirators without breaking their oath, and so they wanted him killed. Men restored to good citizenship without punishment means preserved homes, protected families, and useful lives. Men railroaded to jail means cheap convict labor, and so the jails are full. When the case was called, the prosecutors were present in force, but having had some recent experience with Paul's abilities as a trial lawyer, and realizing the need of quick action for the relief of their starving townsmen, they went to the expense of employing a certain famous orator, Tertullus, who now appeared against Paul, and with the oily words of the flatterer, sought to prejudice the governor against the prisoner and secure a speedy decision in their favor, but he failed. There was no jury now to disagree, but when Paul had concluded his masterly defense, the flimsy argument of the great orator had been smashed into fragments, and the court, unable to find even a pretext to decide, for the prosecution took the case under advisement until he could confer with Lysias. In the meantime, Paul was remanded to the custody of a centurion who had orders to give him liberty and forbid none of his friends to minister or come to him, a victory no less striking than that won before the Sanhedrin at Jerusalem. For 2 years, and until his term of office expired, Felix kept Paul in custody, apparently for no other reason than that he refused to pay for his release. Felix was a weak, cheap grafter, and although he strove hard for popularity, his Jewish subjects finally threw him overboard, for the Hebrew race has never had any use for weaklings. Before his successor was appointed, however, he sent often for Paul in order to give him a chance to broach the subject of paying for his release. But Paul persisted in talking only about righteousness, temperance, and judgment to come, which made Felix tremble. Why should Paul bribe his way out of jail? If the Lord wanted him out, he could shake the doors off their hinges as he did at Philippi. Why should a Christian ever do evil that good may come? Why, merely because he is afraid the Lord won't agree with him as to what is good and desirable, and so he decides to take no chances? Paul was not that kind of a Christian, and so when Felix gave way to his successor, Porcius Festus, he gave the Jews pleasure by leaving Paul in handcuffs. Once more was it necessary for Paul to foil the plots of his enemies before he could start on his long-promised journey to Rome. Another society had been formed to kill him, But having learned something from the experience of the former conspirators, they did not take an oath to not eat anything unless they succeeded. When the new governor paid his first visit to Jerusalem, they presented what seemed like a harmless request, that he send for Paul to Jerusalem for trial, they having made secret arrangements to murder him on the way. This was not an unreasonable request because the offense with which Paul was charged was committed at Jerusalem, and it was the practice then as now to try the prisoner in the city or district where he was charged with having violated the law. But Paul was to go to Rome, and Jerusalem was not on the way. And so the Lord, in whose hand the hearts of kings are as rivers of water, and who turneth them whithersoever he will, caused the governor to refuse the request, and to invite the prosecutors to go down to Caesarea and try their case over again. This they did 10 days later, not taking along this time, however, the orator, Tertullus, who had not been very successful on the last trial, and whose clients had either starved to death or lost confidence in his ability. Instead, they went in large numbers and stood around and made many charges which they could not prove. Festus, who was a very different governor from Felix, was much disappointed at the flimsy kind of evidence which the prosecution produced on this new hearing, and which consisted of certain questions of their own superstition and of one Jesus which was dead, whom Paul affirmed to be alive, the stout-hearted prisoner still insisting upon his plea of not guilty, that neither against the law of the Jews, neither against the temple, nor yet against Caesar, have I offended anything at all. The new governor, evidently struggling between a desire to be popular with the Jews and to be fair to his defenseless prisoner, inquired, "Wilt thou go up to Jerusalem, and there be judged of these things before me?" Here was a new and unexpected problem confronting the resourceful apostle. If he consented to go to Jerusalem, he would be again in the power of his enemies. If he refused, he had no assurance that Festus would not overrule him and grant the Jews' request. He therefore made a move which must have been a mighty surprise to his enemies, a move which put 1,500 miles between him and his persecutors, and effectually blocked every plan which they had made for his speedy destruction. He prayed an appeal to the Emperor Nero himself. His appeal was allowed by Festus, and at last the On to Rome program is to be carried out. One thing, however, still troubled the Roman governor. He had to transfer the case to the Supreme Court, but he didn't like the record he had to send up. What would the emperor think of his method of administering justice if he should send a prisoner at public expense to Rome to take up his valuable time, against whom there was no more serious charge than the breach of some Jewish superstition? Might it not cost him his position to do so? In his perplexity, he received a visit from King Agrippa, the grandson of Herod the Great, whom he told of his difficulty. "It seemeth to me unreasonable," said he, "to send a prisoner and not withal to signify the crimes laid against him." So Agrippa offered to hear Paul himself, that he might be in a position to assist the governor in fixing up a record which he would not be ashamed to submit to the emperor. The next day, therefore, a brilliant assembly, composed of the king and his sister, the governor and the chief captain, and principal men of the city, gathered to hear the much-talked-of prisoner speak for himself, and upon Festus' command, Paul was brought forth. There are many events in sacred and secular history which make our blood flow a little faster, and this courtroom scene is one. Paul, now probably in his 58th year, the grizzled hero of many a hard battle with the enemies of his master, stands alone, chained to a Roman soldier, no doubt the meanest-looking person in that great crowd, but he is still Paul the Ready, as confident and unafraid in the midst of this golden glitter, this pageantry and parade, as when speaking to his little flock at Antioch or singing psalms in the jail at Philippi. And when permission had been given him to speak, he stretched forth his unchained hand and with fine courtesy began that simple testimony to the power of Christ, which brought forth from the startled king the famous declaration, "Almost thou persuadest me to be a Christian." No doubt Luke, the author of the Acts, had worked his way somehow into that august assembly, and was thus able to give to this wonderful scene the lifelike features which it bears. Paul, always in earnest, must have fully appreciated the greatness of this opportunity to speak for Jesus. He must have known that under the Roman law, his appeal to Caesar had removed from the lower court the power to either condemn him or acquit him, so that for himself he had nothing at stake, but the cause of Christ had much at stake. Here was a chance which he had never had before, and might never have again, and right royally did he improve it. Paying no attention to the others, he spoke directly to the king, and in a manner intensely dramatic, told of that wonderful experience on the Damascus road which Luke had recorded twice before. We can imagine how still that courtroom was, for when Festus suddenly interrupted him, the governor's voice seemed to Luke very loud. Paul had just reached his favorite subject, the resurrection, when Festus broke in, and the world lost very much, no doubt, through that interruption. A brilliant idea had just occurred to the Roman governor. If they could not find any criminal charge to put in the record on the appeal, they could allege that the prisoner was insane, and therefore not to be trusted with his liberty. It was too happy a thought to keep to himself, and so he spoke out loud and stopped Paul's great argument at the most interesting point. Nobody else agreed with Festus, but ever since, the world, taking its cue from him, has pronounced mad every man who becomes dead in earnest about religion. He can become greatly excited about politics and business and anything else, but let him get enthusiastic about Jesus Christ, and someone suggests a straitjacket or a padded cell. Again, Paul won his case, and the unanimous verdict of the distinguished jury was, "This man doeth nothing worthy of death or of bonds." And the king announced that had not Paul's appeal deprived the court of jurisdiction, he might have been set at liberty. Did the great apostle make a mistake in praying his appeal and thus preventing his discharge? Many think so, but we cannot agree with them. Had Paul been set free, who can doubt that he would quickly have fallen a victim to the plots of his desperate enemies, and the world would have lost the letters to the Philippians and the Colossians, and Philemon and the Ephesians and Timothy and Titus, all of which were written after this? Let us be truly thankful for the wisdom and skill of the lawyer apostle, who brought such a blessing to us all by winning his case. Of Paul's trial or trials before Nero, we have no authentic information. The haughty monarch was in no hurry to have his leisure interrupted by so trifling a matter as the liberty of a subject. It is possible also that the record of the proceedings at Caesarea, which caused Festus so much trouble, were lost in the shipwreck and had to be replaced, and so, for 2 years, the patient apostle preached and wrote and prayed, while the frequent changing of the guard which kept him permeated the invincible legions of Rome with the gospel. It is entirely possible that some of these converted soldiers carried the message of Christianity to Great Britain, and so we are the direct beneficiaries of the law's delays. It is believed that Paul's success as an advocate resulted in his acquittal, and that after several years of freedom, he was again imprisoned, tried at Rome, and sentenced to death. His Roman citizenship saved him from the disgrace of crucifixion, and hence, according to universal tradition, he was beheaded in the year A.D. 68, the last year of Nero's reign, a victor to the very last. Servant of God, well done, the stress of life is past, the battles fought, the victories won, and thou art crowned at last.